very brief section to introduce the topic. The brief section is titled, Learn One New Word for Today, Paradigm, or alternative title, A Paradigm is a Think With. The Think With, for those of you that don't recall, is a reference back to John's presentation of about 3 weeks ago. He was a little bit hesitant to use it as a noun, but I'm using it as a noun now. It's a way of seeing. It's the glasses that you have on through which you see. It's a mindset through which all data is interpreted. It's a worldview which allows you to see data or interpret data and allows you to make decisions. The word paradigm, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M, P-A-R-A, paradigm, D-I-G-M. A lot of people say paradigm. It's both ways in the dictionary, and I've learned it paradigm, so I'll keep saying that, I think. Is an old word. It means pattern, literally. And it was used originally in grammar lessons to talk about the, there'd be a conjugation paradigm, and you'd conjugate the verb, and if you learned one conjugation, you'd know that pattern for all time. You'd be able to apply it to other conjugations. The word was expanded considerably in its meaning and interpretation by a fellow named Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, writing in the early 60s, I think it was about 1962, on the topic of the structure of scientific revolutions. He has a book by that title. I'm going to start off by reporting on his book. Kuhn came up with some revolutionary and what came to be somewhat controversial ideas with regard to how scientific progress takes place. His book has become a classic. Almost anyone who studies the history of science is familiar with it. As soon as he published it, because it sort of attacked some cherished ideas that the scientific community held, it was under attack. And you'll see why very shortly, as soon as I tell you the thesis of his book and some of the things that he said in the book. Despite the attacks, the book lives on, and some of the ideas in it have been adopted and embraced by sociologists to apply his thinking and his structure of scientific revolution back into the social realm to talk about social change. And it's because of this social application of the scientific ideas that I'm bringing out the all this information about the history of science. The old myth that we mostly grew up with, I know I did, and it's in the textbooks, is that science is basically the accumulation of the facts and theories and the methodologies that are presented in our textbooks. Scientific development is a piecemeal, an incremental process. Each person, each generation, building on the work of the generations before, it comes in little bits and pieces. Every scientist is working to do his part. Science is a process of confirmation and falsification. A thesis is proposed, and you do an experiment to test the thesis, and you either confirm the thesis or you tear it down. Motivation of the scientist, this is the one I like, is the desire to be useful, the excitement of exploring new territory, seeking new phenomena, the hope of finding order in what seems to be a kind of a chaotic universe, and of course the drive to test or challenge established knowledge. In fact, Kuhn says, the individual engaged in normal research problems is almost never doing any of these things. We also have the idea that the scientist is objectively looking for truth. He's looking for the laws of nature, wherever he may find it. So he opens his eyes wide, takes in everything. His values, his prejudices, his preferences do not or should not get in the way, should not enter in. Kuhn attacks this. Finally, he says that the archetype of what scientific thinking is that the choice between competing theories should be made by rational, logical comparison with experiment. And the disagreement can always be resolved by experimental test. That's sort of the keystone of the scientific method. Kuhn says that's not right either. What does Kuhn say? In a nutshell, I'll try to keep it really brief because I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. That science does not develop by a piecemeal accumulation of knowledge, of individual discoveries and inventions. Rather, that the progress is not a continuous or incremental process, but occurs in major leaps, which he calls scientific revolutions. He also calls them changes of paradigm or paradigm. These are major discontinuities in the flow or the history of science. Sometimes you think about these. Sure, you know that Einstein was a great man, and you know that he came up with the theory of relativity. But somehow you think of theory of relativity as being sort of an incremental addition to our knowledge, maybe a slightly larger increment, but still sort of an incremental addition. It was not, in Kuhn's thesis. It was a revolution. It was a major overthrow of Newtonian way of looking at the universe and a whole new way of seeing space and time related to one another. It involved a new definition of space, a new definition of time, and a new definition of their interaction. And the outcome was revolutionary. Another classic example, in fact, the example from which Kuhn drew most of his thesis, is the example of the Copernican Revolution. Copernicus was the fellow who said, "No, the Earth is not at the center of the universe. The Sun is at the center of the universe. And look how much neater it is if we put the Sun at the center of the universe. Suddenly, all these hairy calculations you've been doing make sense and look a lot more simple. The planets are all moving around the Sun." Well, of course, he was a heretic, because it says right in the Bible that the Earth, in effect, that the Earth is at the center and the Sun is moving around the Earth and all these things were created later. The Earth was obviously had to be created first and is in the middle. That's not quite right. Actually, the theory of light was first, wasn't it? Early. But the church was very upset by Copernicus and his followers. And the change in mindset that was brought about by having the Earth no longer at the center of the universe was very, very hard for mankind to adjust to. It suddenly brought man down from the pedestal that he felt himself on in some way. So these major changes in the history of science, Kuhn calls paradigm changes or revolutions. So what is a paradigm? I've kind of given you clues. Kuhn's definition is this: the constellation of beliefs, values, assumptions, myths, priorities, techniques, theory, application, methodologies, instrumentation, shared by members of a given community.
You say the constellation?
The conglomeration of beliefs, values. Let me just say it briefly. Basically, the beliefs shared by members of a given community. Okay? But throughout the book, he expands that. Beliefs, values, assumptions, the assumptions you make, the myths you hold, the priorities to which you ascribe, the techniques you use, the theory that you adhere to, the applications of that theory, the methodologies you use for discovery, the instrumentation you use for testing your theory. All those things may at certain times be shared by members of a given community. And that he calls the conglomerate of all those things he calls a paradigm. You want one word for it? A worldview. I think that's probably the best word. A worldview. How about a think with? Okay, that's the connection. The shared paradigm allows what Kuhn calls normal science. And that's textbook science. Normal science is really the textbook science. It's research based firmly on one or more past scientific achievements acknowledged by the community as supplying, for a time, foundation for further research. Normal science, he says, is paradigm articulation. It's a clarification of what those beliefs, values, etc. are. When he's more cynical, he calls it a strenuous and devoted attempt to force nature into the conceptual boxes supplied by professional education. But that's not bad. Maybe that's very good. To strenuously attempt to force nature, force the things you see into the conceptual boxes that you've been supplied with. Because what happens if you pursue normal science is eventually, at least it's happened historically, eventually you can't fit nature into those conceptual boxes anymore. And this energetic attempt to force nature into the boxes is, what Kuhn says, the quickest way to find out where our boxes are going to break down, are going to break. And then we have to redefine our boxes, our categories. That's a paradigm shift, that's a revolution. What happens when you have a shared paradigm?
Have a lot shared?
A shared paradigm. What does that allow you to do? What is the nature of this normal science? Okay, there's three things that Kuhn points out. The first is that the definition of what are problems, the definition of the problems, and the priority of their importance is uniformly known and subscribed to by the community. You know what the problems are and you know what their priority is. And you agree on that, and everybody's kind of attacking the same problems. The rules of the game of problem solving are established. The paradigm gives you rules of the game. It also confers confidence among the practitioners of the science that solutions do in fact exist, and that if we persevere, we'll find those solutions. So normal science really is sort of puzzling out the solutions that are known to exist. In fact, he at one point calls the normal science puzzle solving, and the challenge of the scientist . The motivation of the scientist really is, if only I am skillful enough, I will succeed in solving this puzzle that no one before me has solved or has solved so well. That's kind of a cynical attitude about scientific research, but I've seen it as a scientist throughout the scientific community, that the goal is to succeed in solving a puzzle better than anyone else has ever solved it before. And in fact, the goal is often to get your results published before your competitor in the next research lab publishes his. Because if you can publish your results first, you're going to be in line for a federal grant before he's in line for a federal grant. That's a real cynical attitude. Okay, if paradigm supplies the definition of the problems, their priority, the rules of the game, and confidence that solutions exist, therefore, the discussions within the community practicing normal science center on things like the validity of the data. Is your data valid? Or they center on the actual carrying out of the problem-solving procedure. But they do not center on definition of problems, or existence of solutions, or validity of procedures. Those are all given you by the paradigm. You do not challenge your paradigm as long as it's working. That's what he's saying. Okay, now what are the implications of all that? I'm going to draw implications into the social realm and say that once a community or a society or a government or a people gather together and share a paradigm, they hardly even realize that they share one because it's so implicit, it's so well understood. And as long as they have this shared paradigm, nobody asks questions about, are we defining our problems correctly? Are the things that we consider important really important? That's not a concern. It takes somebody outside the paradigm to ask those questions. Do solutions in fact exist? Maybe they don't. Maybe we've defined the problem in such a way that solutions don't exist. But as long as we have a paradigm to agree upon, we assume that solutions exist. Are we trying to solve the problems in the correct way? Is the validity of our procedures, are our procedures valid? Nobody asks that question if they're inside the paradigm. This idea has been picked up by the social scientists, as I said, and the best statement I've seen of it is in a book called Arc 2, Arc Roman numeral 2, the Ark, reference back to the Ark of Noah, referring to the spaceship Earth floating through space, and we have to take care of our Ark. It's written by Paul Ehrlich, same fellow who wrote Population Bomb, one of the biggies that kind of burst open the environmental movement. And a fellow named Dennis Pirages, P-I-R-A-G-E-S. And they say, the collection of norms, beliefs, values, habits, and so on that form the worldview most commonly or influentially held within a culture and transmitted from generation to generation by social institutions may be called a dominant social paradigm. Paradigm is the prominent worldview, or model, or frame of reference through which individuals, or collectively a society, interpret the meaning of the external world. A shared paradigm makes organized activity possible and guides behavior and expectations. Clear? Simple enough? That helps, doesn't it? So normal science proceeds. Everything is fine. I want to give you a little example. It's kind of fun. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen this. Okay, what does that say?
Burden does on hand.
Yay, Tom.
Oh.
There's two does. You had a paradigm, you had a way of seeing that immediately stuck that into a category that already existed in your mind. And it looked like it said, burden the hand. So you actually didn't take in all the data, did you? And evaluate it objectively. You eliminated part of the data because it didn't fit in your preconceived categories. Another nice example I like is a psychological test that they used about 20 years ago, I think. Some psychologists got a deck of cards, and they put a little screen in front of the deck, and they would flash the cards to people. And they would find that, you know, even like a tenth of a second or a twentieth of a second glimpse at a card was enough to allow a person to recognize what the card was. And they'd go through their deck, card after card, and the person would say, okay, that's a four of clubs, that's a three of spades, that's a nine of hearts, and they'd get it right with certain speed. But then they'd throw them a catch. They'd throw in a black six of hearts. And they'd identify it either as a six of spades or a six of hearts. Without hesitation, as long as they just got a glimpse of it. But as they extended the duration of the shutter being open, pretty soon when they'd come to that black six of hearts, people would hesitate. First they'd just hesitate, and then they'd identify it, and they'd feel comfortable. Then pretty soon they'd hesitate longer, or they'd say, you know, the shutter closed, and they'd say, that was a... They feel this profound discomfort and insecurity because it wasn't fitting into their box. And for a while, they'd still cram it into a box. But finally, they'd say, that was a black six of hearts. Then once they had seen that, once they had expanded their categories, then from then on, if you throw them a red four of spades, they'd say, ah, that's a red four of spades, uh-huh. and they'd know it. The same thing happens in science. There's a time when the professional community tries very hard to cram the data into the boxes. And in fact, to such an extent that they'll even ignore some of the data. It doesn't fit. It's not that they'll ignore it. It's not dishonesty. It's that they don't even see it. For a long time, there have been asteroids up in the sky that could be seen with telescopes. But they weren't seen until the first one was discovered. And as soon as the first one was discovered, then suddenly a whole rash of discoveries of asteroids were seen, because the possibility for the existence of asteroids was established. And then by golly, everybody saw them, and they found that, golly, here on old plates, we should have seen them. Here it is, that this thing is moving. And they hadn't noticed them before. There's a lot of examples. The Chinese used to see sunspots way back a couple thousand years before Christ. They were seeing sunspots because they would project the sun through a pinhole camera, and they'd seek an image of the sun. They'd watch the sunspots move around, and they'd trace them. They knew about 11-year sunspot cycle and all this kind of stuff. The Europeans didn't know anything about sunspots. They didn't know anything about sunspots until like 1700 or 1800s, because they didn't allow for the possibility of sunspots. Even things like, well, another one of my favorites is, there was that great supernova back in 1033 or something like that, an incredibly bright star shone in the sky, and the Chinese recorded it. It looks like maybe even the American Indians recorded it. Some people get that from cave drawings. But the Europeans didn't make no record of having seen this thing. Yeah. And either the records were lost, which is possible, or else it was so threatening to them, so it didn't fit that there should be something like this in the daytime, that they just wouldn't observe it. They wouldn't acknowledge its existence. This happened in later years, too, with relativity and with all kinds of things. There's a lot of examples, but I don't want to bog down on that. So what do you do when you're confronted with this anomaly? You force it into boxes for a while. Pretty soon, you can't fit it in there anymore, and you feel this profound insecurity. There's a big conflict then, typically, in the scientific community, between the people who want to change the rules and come up with a new theory which sort of explains things, and the old people that want to hold on to the old rules. Kuhn's point, and the point I want to emphasize, is not the big fight and what it's all about, but that the choice between competing paradigms cannot be determined by the evaluative procedures characteristic of normal science. Because the evaluative procedures, the procedures used to evaluate, depend in part upon the particular paradigm. And it's the paradigm itself that is at issue. So if you're trying to persuade somebody that you have a better value system, what can you appeal to? They've got different values, you've got different values. How can you persuade them that yours is better? Better by what standard? He says, the issue of paradigm choice can never be unequivocally settled by logic and experiment alone. Eventually, it's a matter of faith, and he uses the word faith. He talks about a conversion experience. He talks about a gestalt switch, a whole flip over of your mindset, when all of a sudden you say, yep, I see it. The old theory is fallen. I'm going to embrace the new theory. But now it's not that simple. You'd think, well, eventually you get enough evidence that persuades people. He says, very often, despite the fact that a lot of people have been persuaded, there are some people that go to their grave believing in the old theory, because the evidence is never conclusive. The evidence is never conclusive.
People still think the moonshot was a TV show.
Right.
What?
And what would it take to persuade them that it wasn't? They could see rockets going up, they could see photographs, they could see almost anything they want, and they could still think it's a TV show. And the evidence, you'd almost have to put them on the moon. And even then, they'd wonder if it was simulated or hallucinatory or something, probably. So. Okay, that's a new view of science, I think, for most of you, probably.
What's the name of his book?
The Structure of Scientific Revolution.
And when was it published?
About 62.
I heard Tom Etter, a quantum physicist, for 15 minutes, and I asked a question. And he said, to answer that, I'd have to get technical. And I said, what have you been for the last 15 minutes? And the whole room collapsed, because no one had understood it. And so he finally said, it's like coming to the local person who has the horse and the carriage and the, what was it called then, when you hired the liveryman of the town, and you had in mind a horseless carriage, an internal combustion engine, and you wanted him to know that you had another way to transport people. And all he could ask was, will it be a new way to shoe my horses or feed my horses? All of his questions were within the structure of his having a horse and a carriage and delivering people. And so he could never understand a horseless carriage. And that, I mean, you've said it very well, the kinds of things that he was trying to say as to what quantum physics meant as over against Newtonian physics, mm-hmm. and how you couldn't even ask the questions unless you had a new mindset, unless you had a new worldview, paradigm, what have you.
That reminds me of, I've got to get this illustration out too. The question for a long time, once the idea that the Earth went around the Sun came up, was, well, how does the Earth get pushed around the Sun? And so they were inventing angels flying around behind the Earth, pushing it in a circle around the Sun. And then Newton came along, and Newton said, no, there's nothing pushing the Earth around the Sun, pushing from behind the Earth, pushing it around the Sun in its orbit. Rather, there's gravity, which attracts the Earth to the Sun and holds it in an orbit. And without the gravity, the Earth would just continue on in a straight line. He thought it was a stroke of genius. A lot of people thought it was a stroke of genius. And some people just thought, well, that's nothing. You're just saying that you're just inventing a new word for angels. And you haven't really answered the fundamental question, and that's why does it keep going around the Sun? Newton changed the question. He said the profound question is not why does it keep going around the Sun. Let's see. The question really is not why does it keep going around the Sun. No, let me say. I can't really explain it. Anyway, he restated the problem, basically, is what he did. And so even though he came up with an answer to the wrong problem, or what other people, he thought it was an answer, and the scientific community for the next 300 years considers it a fine answer. Oh, we've got gravity, and that explains everything. But it really didn't answer the original question, because he changed the question and answered a new question. Okay. All that is by way of introduction to, let's pass these around. What I consider, and what a lot of people consider, to be the paradigm conflict of our age. So I called the title of the next part of the talk, Forwardism versus Futurism, the paradigm conflict of our age. The only way I feel to really understand what's going on in the world today is to try to make some sense out of all the information we get in, is to try to simplify things a little bit. This is one attempt at simplification, at categorization. And anytime you do that, anytime you set up a dichotomy, there's going to be exceptions. And it's going to not really exactly represent what's going on. But despite that, I think it's sufficiently helpful that it's worth spending time on. Somebody said there's two kinds of people in this world. There's those that lump the world into two kinds of people and those that don't. Well, today I'm lumping the world into two kinds of people. What I'm really doing is lumping myself into two kinds of people, too. I'm saying that that there are parts of me, parts of my heritage, parts of my value system that is sort of one kind of person and part that's another kind of person. But the remarkable thing is that the conflict between these two categories that we're going to talk about turns out to be remarkably the battle lines or the lines of division between them turn out to be remarkably well drawn. people have been starting to point to this. Maybe 10 years ago, they started to talk about this kind of dichotomy. Some authors have come up with names for it. I've got a couple in the... I've come up with the names Forwardism and Futurism. A fellow named Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful, calls the Forwardists the people of the forward stampede. That's pretty derogatory. And calls the Futurists the homecomers. Victor Firkas calls the Forwardists classical liberals. Classical meaning growing out of the long American and European tradition of liberalism, going back to the Declaration of Independence and this kind of thing. Thomas Locke. Richard Nixon. He's a classical liberal, by the way. And he calls the Futurists ecological humanists. Kenneth Boulding says the Forwardists have a cowboy or a frontier mentality. The Futurists have a spaceship Earth mentality. What's the difference between a cowboy mentality or a frontier mentality and a spaceship Earth mentality? The frontier mentality basically feels that man is a kind of a small perturbation on what's going on. There's vast horizons out there if you're in the frontier. There's no limits. You're in an infinite world. And you are limited only by your own lack of creativity, lack of initiative, lack of energy. But there's no real physical limits to the frontier mind. The spaceship Earth mentality is just the opposite of that. It says the Earth is a spaceship. We're a little spaceship in a vast universe of nothing that we know of. And here we are trying to keep this spaceship alive. It's the only humanity that we know of in the universe, and we're trying to live on this little spaceship. And so all the things we do on this little spaceship have to be sort of internally consistent. There's only one energy source for the spaceship. What is it? Sun. Yeah, that's all we got. So unless we start using up stuff on the Earth, which is a possibility. Okay, let's go back now. I've kind of jumped ahead to give you an idea of Forwardism and Futurism. I first want to say that point zero, I'm not counting people who are diabolical and evil and out for greed, who don't like people, who feel that they ought to get all they can get, and heck with whether there's people starving or not. I'm not counting that. That's a whole different category. And maybe that's the majority. I don't know. But I'm going to say that Forwardist and Futurist both seek a world of sustainable peace, a world of prosperity, a world of health and vitality, a world of creativeness, and of brotherhood. So they at least share those common values. But now where they go from there is up for grabs. Okay, here we go. I'm just going to mostly read through this pretty fast. Don't have a whole lot of time. And then come back to, I'd like to save some time at the end for discussion. So if you pick up on points that you'd like to come back to, put a little check mark in your margin. We'll come back and discuss particular ones in detail. I'm not going to try and discuss each point. I could talk for half an hour about almost every one of these points, but I won't. Be thankful. This is like 3 weeks worth of course material. Okay, the Forwardists. To them, the future is an extrapolation of the progress of the past. Our past successes for mankind have been remarkable. Today's problems, which admittedly are many, although most have always been with us, can and will be overcome by renewed determination and redoubled efforts. The problems are known and subscribed to. All it takes is puzzle solving. Futurists say, in contrast to that, mankind is at a major evolutionary turning point, comparable to the discovery of agriculture 12,000 years ago, something like that. Today's problems are extraordinary because of their global nature and because of their interrelatedness, and cannot be overcome by prevalent methods, ideologies, and values. Indeed, proposed solutions frequently aggravate the two true problems. In other words, often the Forwardists don't even define the problems correctly. And when they try to solve what they think are the problems, they're aggravating the true problems. New values will be required to move mankind into a new epoch. That's Jonas Salk's word. Into a new epoch without disaster. Point two, the forwardists, their slogans are things like onward and upward, California or bust, more is better, progress is our most important product, growth is good, efficiency is good. Progress is equated with increased material affluence, and this is equated in turn with steady economic growth. Both of those equations are challenged by the futurists. Their goal is to maximize production with minimum financial cost. That sounds like a pretty good goal, actually. The somewhat condescending phrase you can apply to this kind of growth is adolescent growth. It's growth of size. It's the growth that you do when you're a child growing to adulthood. It's a very reasonable type of growth. When you increase your body size, you do that kind of growth. More of same. When a civilization reaches maturity, it can no longer expand its size, its population, in effect, and must grow in other ways. And that's what the futurists look toward. More of many things may not be better. The question is, more of what and why? Growth is often bad and pathological. For example, cancer, classic case of bad growth or pathological growth. Efficiency standards, as applied by the forwardists, frequently fail to take many hidden costs into account. Progress should be measured in human or spiritual terms. Slogan has become small as beautiful, title of Schumacher's book. Their goal is efficiency in the use of human, energy, and material resources. Human resources, energy resources, and material resources. Back to forwardists. This is a world of infinite possibilities. The sky is the limit. Means there are no limits. What man can imagine, he can achieve. The futurists. The material earth is finite. This is, in fact, one of the things that defines really futurism. The material earth is finite. Land, air, water, non-renewable resources, waste-absorbing capacity, carrying capacity, all finite. But we have scarcely begun to explore any limits of man. Growth may continue indefinitely in non-material realms like happiness, knowledge, justice, delight in work or service, health, love, brotherhood. We should recognize and choose our material limits before they are forced upon us, and thereby free ourselves to explore new realms of human growth. You can tell I'm biased. I mean, obviously. Even the column over here in Futurism is longer than the column in Forwardism, so I haven't been quite fair to Forwardism. There are a lot of good things to be said for Forwardism. My father was a Forwardist. I love him a lot. He was a great... He just retired after 41 years of service with International Harvester Company, doing great things for promoting... developing new forms of farm equipment so that we could more efficiently feed the world. I really respect what he did. And yet, he has a great deal of difficulty understanding why my values are futuristic rather than forwardistic, because he feels that we can kind of continue the way we are. He wants approval for what his generation did. And while I can, in one sense, do that, I want to say, but it's no longer right for what the problem is now. Okay, interlude. Step four. As the rich get richer, the poor are pulled up behind them. There is hope for the world's poor only in eventual development along the lines of Western industrialization and technology. That's where the hope is. The futurists say the present world economic structures aggravate the gap between rich and poor. The poor nations will never develop and can never develop and probably even should never develop in the footsteps of the developed nations. A new definition of development and new appropriate technologies are required. The forwardists are sometimes called technological fatalists. That's the negative way of saying it, but really they have faith in technology to solve problems, particularly high, advanced, new, or yet to be discovered technology. Their slogan might be that necessity is the mother of invention, and they believe that as a problem arises, as the problem becomes serious enough, we'll concentrate our energies on it sufficiently that we can solve it. great deal of confidence. The futurists are technological skeptics. They have a mistrust of facile technological fixes for profound socioeconomic and political problems. High technology is often not the cure, but the problem itself. Technology can be beneficial when it pays, but technology can be beneficial when it pays its full social cost. Their claim would be that technology today often does not pay its full social cost. There are so many spillover effects, side effects, that it is not the kind of technology we need. Forwardism. Society is bettered by each individual bettering himself. Emphasis is on the self, on self-fulfillment, self-expression, self-achievement, self-actualization. Futurism. Man is intrinsically a social creature. We exist, we learn, we achieve identity only through relations with others. Our social interactions are both overt and covert. Failure to recognize this interdependence leads to many tragedies of the commons, in which optimum social benefit is not achieved by each individual working, to benefit himself. True self-actualization is impossible without family, community, and world actualization. I think it was that statement, in effect, was said by somebody like Albert Schweitzer, who, by Maslow's hierarchy of values, is one of the most self-actualized people in the world. And yet, he was saying, I can't be totally self-actualized. He didn't say use these words, they were Maslow's words, but I'm not fulfilled as long as my brother's suffering. As long as my family, my community, or my world is not actualized, I am not whole. Forwardists. It is man's evolutionary or God-mandated destiny to have dominion over, that is to dominate and subdue, nature. Resources and other things of this earth are given to man to use. Futurism. Man is part of nature, a steward of nature, a caretaker of nature. His health is intrinsically bound up with the health of his ecosystem. Resources are gifts to all mankind and are to be husbanded, shepherded. Man is no longer a small perturbation on the biosphere, on the ecosphere. Those aren't contradictory, really, but it's just a little difference in emphasis. 8. Wealth arises out of virtue, out of cleverness, out of hard work. It is God's reward to good people. This is a very American point of view. The last statement I just had to throw in there, I don't think too many people say that much anymore, but you still hear it. Wealth arises out of virtue, American ingenuity, cleverness, hard work, and God rewards good people with wealth. Futurists take a much more pragmatic view about wealth. Wealth is either a gift, as resources are a gift, inheritances are gifts. Certainly my wealth is an inheritance from my father and forefather and forefather, not in this country. I mean, the wealth of the country today is an inheritance of our past generations in this country. For birthright, I happen to be born an American. It didn't arise out of my virtue, cleverness, or hard work. Or some wealth is covertly stolen, as in the tragedy of the commons. You take what seems to be yours, or what seems to be everybody's, you take a little bit for your share, and it turns out that because you've taken some, somebody has less. It's a covert form of stealing. Or simply good fortune, chance. With finite wealth, what one man has or gains is the loss of another. 9. We have a laissez-faire, capitalist, free enterprise economy, and it would work fine if the government would just leave it alone. Okay, in contrast to that, we have an economy which is at least 50% planned and controlled, in which market forces do not operate, in which growth, rather than maximum profit, is sought for the power and control that it offers. So let's at least face up to what we really have. If we want to have a laissez-faire capitalist free enterprise economy, fine. But let's don't think that we have it, or if the government would immediately cease and desist doing things, we would have it. Let's acknowledge what we do have. Freedom is not having someone tell you what to do. That's the definition of freedom. It's the absence of coercion. It's doing what you really want to do. It's doing what's really you. Then you're free. It is most threatened today by federal regulations, or some people would say, in doing what's really you, it's threatened by other people telling you what to do, social customs that you have to conform with. Okay, in contrast, futurism says we are never free from the influence and coercion of others. That's what man being intrinsically a social creature means. We are the product of all those influences. Freedom is more like having the ability and the spirit, the vitality, to choose our constraints. Freedom is also the ability to have a future, to have a future guaranteed to you. Freedom is most threatened by the military, industrial, labor, government establishment, and by resource and information control. 11. Being rich means having a lot of whatever. Rich is having a lot of something. Money, land, possessions, cars. In futurism, being rich means having a balance, a wholeness, a shalom, and may include, in addition to food, shelter, and clothing, health, satisfying relationships, a sense of belonging, fulfilling work, the health of your brothers, hope for the future. The last page is just a bunch of one-shot things. Differences in emphasis, differences in concern. We've sort of talked now about the differences in values or myths, assumptions, differences in assumptions. Now, these are just sort of differences in techniques or differences in the things that you hold important, differences in the things you pay attention to, in the words that crop up, the language that occurs in one paradigm as compared to the language that occurs in the other paradigm. Forwardism is concerned with quantity. This is really loaded, okay, and it's very, I'm drawing the dichotomy very sharply, but I think when you take it all as a whole, you get a feeling for what's going on. Forwardism is concerned with quantity. That's why we're measuring things all the time. That's why the physicists always measure things and the economists always measure things. It wasn't enough to say economics. We started to have to say econometrics, which means measuring the economy. Futurism is concerned with quality or character, nature of things. Not so much their number, but their quality. Forwardism, numbers, degrees, how much. Futurism, relationships, direction, order of magnitude thinking. The important things, there are mathematical techniques to handle groups and relationships amongst things. We've forgotten all that because it was discovered later. The first thing we discovered was numbers. And so we have a society that's enmeshed with numbers to the point that we can no longer see relationships. Know-how and technique are important things in forwardism. Know-why and purpose are important things in futurism. Remember the cartoon with the 747? They have the know-how, but do they have the know-why? Machine, mechanics, classical physics are the ideas of forwardism versus organism, life, and biology in futurism. That hurts. As a physicist. Notice I had to say classical physics. I think modern physics is getting closer to biology in some of its approaches. Things, materialism versus ideas, idealism. Energy and matter flow are the big concerns. Transportation, we transport things around this country like crazy. It's coming to be rather an era of information flow. This Perlman, a guy I like, wrote a book called The Global Mind. He calls the old world, the forwardist world, the hard world, and futurist world, soft world. It's a takeoff on the computer terms hardware and software. Hardware is the machine itself. Software is all the programs you put into the machine. So the software is the information. The hardware is the substance. Self, social independence on the forwardist side, and community and social interdependence on the futurist side. I want to be free. I want to have my nuclear family, settle in my house. I want to put up my fence, have my dog. Boom. There I am.
Concrete yard. Yeah. Smart cat.
Right. Okay. There it is. And I don't want people telling me what to do. But, nevertheless, we are highly economically interdependent. I do one little tiny role in the whole overall economy, and we've got a high division of labor. I think that's going to come next, or a little ways down the scale. High division of labor. And so I do not grow my own food. I do not put up my own house. I do instead consulting for such and such or whatever. In futurist, the emphasis is more on community rather than on self. An acknowledgement of social interdependence. We depend on each other very strongly for our identity, for support, for confession, forgiveness. But we can have a sense of economic independence. An emphasis more on local autonomy, of growing your own food, weaving your own cloth, spinning your own yarn, raising your own sheep, doing whatever. Forwardism is atomistic and reductionist. Do you know those words? Atomism is the whole trend of science through the ages has been to try and break things down into smaller and smaller pieces so we can understand the most basic elemental atom. And the belief was, the faith was, that boy, if we can understand what's going on in the atom, then we can understand what's going on in the molecule. And if we can understand the molecule, we can understand the protein. And if we can understand the protein, we can understand the cell, the DNA. And if we can understand the DNA, we can understand the cell. If we can understand the cell, we can understand people. If we can understand people, we can understand societies. If we can understand societies, we can understand the universe. You know, that's how it goes, okay? But that sort of faith or that pretentiousness has broken down. It's not enough to understand the atom. When you understand the atom, you don't understand societies. At each step of that hierarchy, whole new techniques and whole new properties emerge. These are called emergent properties of systems. The fact that you as an organism have properties that your individual component cells would never dream of. You're more than just the sum of all your cells. In fact, the way you know that is that when you die, those cells somehow disperse to dust. You are nothing more than dust, and yet you have an entityness, you have a systems characteristic, you have emergent behavior, emergent properties. That's going to come way down at the very end somewhere. So futurism puts an emphasis on holism and the need for understanding structures holistically. Parts do not make the whole. The whole is more than just the parts, the sum of the parts. Ever heard the concept of synergy? It's an in word now. Synergy. Synergy, I think it's one of the first places it came. It's sympathetic energy, or I'm not sure what it comes from exactly, but it comes, came one of the early uses, which was in synergic medicine. You use two medicines. You put this medicine with this medicine, and this one would kill you, and this one would kill you, but the two together make you well.
Oh, no.
The whole is more than the sum of the parts. And there are a lot of synergic effects going on in society. And I would say a community of Christians can do far more than the Christians as individuals, for example. That's a synergic effect. Forwardism. Disjoint incrementalism, that's a big one, in problem solving or public policy, versus futurism, synoptic planning or problem solving. Okay, let's go on that one. Disjoint incrementalism is, first let's take the word disjoint. That means, that's atomism again, reductionism. You break the problem up into little parts. And you solve it step by step. You break the problem into parts, and you solve this part, you solve this part, you solve this part, and then, and you, you maybe don't solve it all at once. Even this little part, you may not solve all at once. You solve it a little bit, you wait and look, and you solve a little bit more, you wait and look, you do a little bit more on it, you wait and look, and you do the same thing with each of the parts, and that is supposed to go all together and solve the whole. Okay, in a loosely bound system, that works. In a tightly bound system, or in a system with a lot of interactions, that doesn't work anymore. You try and solve this part over here and tweak, you pop something up over here. The parts interreact so much that you almost have to look at the whole and devise some kind of grand scheme that solves the whole thing at once. Ah, sounds impossible. And often it is. Often we still, to be able to cope at all, have to reduce things down to little parts and play around with them. But we've got to be aware that that's a constraint on the possibilities, on your options. And maybe not all problems can be solved that way. That's one of the rules of the game. One of the rules of the game today is to use just disjoint incrementalism, to change things by increments. We pass a new law. Maybe a new law can never solve the problem. Maybe we need a new constitution, for example. Synoptic means seeing all things at once or something? What does it mean, John?
See with the same eyes, at least.
See with the same eyes? With your same eyes, you see everything, I think. I'm going to put all in there somehow, too. And you, with those eyes, you devise a grand design. I've got to take a quantum leap, take a paradigm shift into the future, into a new world, paint that new world with all the colors that it needs to be itself self-consistent, and then go back and say, okay, now, can I get there from here? Or if so, how and what? But you've got to do a grand design to be able to maybe make the changes that are required. You can't, as I said one time, you can't get from here to here in small increments. In a forwardist society, social control is formalized. There's laws, it's regulatory. If you've got a problem, you pass a law, you make a regulation. In a futurist society, ideally, the regulations are on the feedback loops. You sort of subtly integrate, you make one little change down here, and if you understand the system well enough, it compounds and flows throughout the system and makes everything hang together. It's sort of like our problem with the smoke going up the chimney and trying to get a way that the whole valley can live together if we all want to put up chimneys. You make one little regulation, or it's not really regulation, but you say, we'll structure things in such a way that the incentive structure will encourage us to put up a fireplace if it's beneficial, and will discourage us from putting up a fireplace if it's not beneficial. And if you structure society in the right way, you can get a kind of organic control of what's going on. Some people call this informal social control as opposed to formal social control. The emphasis there on those last two things in parentheses is between a citified or urban type of society and a rural type of society, which the futuristic society tends to be more like the communal or rural structure, where controls are more informal, where it's tradition that tells you what to do, where it's peer pressure that tells you what to do. Nobody writes down a list of laws, it's just sort of understood, the norms are understood. I have written the law in thy hearts. Forwardists are concerned with personal violence, especially overt violence, hitting somebody on the head, being mugged. Futurists are concerned with institutionalized violence, particularly covert violence. The violence, okay, I won't elaborate on that. Forwardists, large-scale centralized production, decision-making, and control. Futurists, small-scale, decentralized production, decision-making, and control. Forwardists, efficiency, standardization, and uniformity are goals or important concepts. In futurism, diversity itself is an important thing. You may lose efficiency by having diversity, but diversity is a virtue in itself. Cultural homogeneity on the forwardist side, you can see, you know, things like they want to institute a universal monetary system around the world. Get rid of all these various currencies. Just look at all the trouble they're causing, and let's all deal with one currency. Well, maybe that's good for economics, and maybe it's more efficient. But it sure is really fun to look at a French franc. And you're losing something when you've lost the cultural heterogeneity. Forwardists, as part of their appreciation of high technology, like things like fusion, solar satellites for energy. Futurists want ground-based solar energy. Notice that's also decentralized, whereas these others are centralized. And radical conservation, and/or radical conservation. Forwardists value complexity. They're proud of their complexity. And they're proud. They're proud of their pride. Pride is a virtue. It is. I mean, pride, let's be proud of ourselves. We're doing good things. Pride is a virtue. And complexity is valued. You admire experts. You admire people that are very intelligent and can deal with these computer models and all this kind of stuff. Complexity is not seen as an evil very often in the forwardist mentality. The complexity is deliberately avoided in the futurist idea. And I've got it, that's such an important point, and I want to read a special quote on that. This is Aurelio Pecci. He happened to be one of the businessmen who was instrumental in starting the Club of Rome, who did the Limits to Growth Studies. And he says, "Man has committed himself to constructing ever larger and more complex artificial systems to such an extent that it has become difficult for him to control them. And he has thereby lost a sense of his destiny and at the same time that of his communion with nature and with the transcendent. No one can say with certainty, but psychic and social damage warn us that inner limits of man have perhaps been surpassed, that our minds and our nervous systems cannot take much more overloading. Our systems have become so complex." This effect is compounded, this is my addition, this effect is compounded for simple people. The ability to function effectively within a complex society has become another criterion for elitism, another badge of achievement to allow a minority to assert superiority over the majority. Experts can create ever more complex systems in order to elevate themselves above others who might learn to use the system if it remained simple. Trained specialists tend to complexify their fields to make themselves indispensable. This social mechanism leads, moreover, to one of the characteristic follies of our time, doing something not because it is desirable to do it, but because it can be done. Okay. So simplicity is thought, oh, I know, oh, wait a minute. One more. This is Schumacher. "It's my experience that it is rather more difficult to recapture directness and simplicity than to advance in the direction of ever more sophistication and complexity. Any third-rate engineer or researcher can increase complexity, but it takes a certain flair of real insight to make things simple again." I love that. And finally, out of Ecclesiastes, "God made man simple. Man's complex problems are of his own devising." Forwardism, hierarchical, bureaucratic, futurism, horizontal relationships are emphasized, and cybernetic. I won't go into the elaboration of what the term cybernetic means. Talk to me about it sometime if you want to find out more. Forwardism, high division of labor and high role differentiation. We've already talked about this. Futurism, low division of labor, low role differentiation. Forwardism. A fellow called Tournies has talked about urban community versus rural community. Basically, he uses the terms Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft as two types of social structures. And he calls what I'm calling forwardism an associational, rational, that is analytical, urban affiliation as compared to a communal, traditional, with emphasis on intuitive, rural fellowship. Notice the parallels all the way along. Affiliation versus fellowship. Forwardism is production. I mean, the word you hear all the time is production, and it's product-oriented. The emphasis in futurism is on distribution. Distribution takes priority, in a sense, over production. And it's process-oriented rather than product-oriented. What's going on, not what are we making. Premium on capital in forwardism. Capital employs labor. We all know that. Capital employs labor. Futurists say the premium is on people. People employ capital. People use their capital equipment to do things. Forwardists, emphasis on competition. Futurists, emphasis on cooperation. Forwardists, emphasis on institutional survival. Futurists, emphasis on effective realization of the goals. And if this means that institutions come and go, so what? Forwardists. The forwardist society is well adapted. It's probably the best adapted society that could be. But it's so well adapted, it fits so perfectly into its niche, that if you change that niche a little bit, it can crumble, it can be ossified, it can be rigid, and can break. A futurist society puts emphasis on adaptability, flexibility. That's why the diversity. That's why it wants to be diverse, decentralized, because then it's more adaptable, and it's therefore less vulnerable to change. A classic example is the bombing of North Vietnam. If you bombed any industrialized society like we bombed North Vietnam, it would fall readily, because you'd hit the heart, the hearts. You'd wipe out the industrialization sector. You'd wipe out the oil depots. You'd wipe out the communications network. All you have to do is, you know, bomb the telephone company, the centralized telephone network, and you'd really wipe things out. A centralized high technology society is very vulnerable. But you could bomb the heck out of North Vietnam, and there's all these people scattered all over, each little unit able to survive and do its own thing on its own. And within days, they'd put bridges back up, because they weren't all that fancy a bridge in the first place. They'd get rice out of the local fields, they'd do whatever they had to do to restore what was damaged. Their supply lines, they had such an incredible network of supply lines that, you know, you damage this line, they've got another one. You damage this line, they've got another one. Rebuilt. It's just because it was a low technology society, because it was very adaptable and not highly adapted society. We're more highly adapted than they are. We're more successful than they are, in a sense. Okay, forwardism, low tolerance of diversity, ambiguity, conflict. That goes along with this rationalism. A computer can't handle ambiguity. Computers get really frustrated when you don't tell them exactly what's going on. You've got to put in an exact figure for everything, or they get frustrated. The human mind does sort of, because it works logically. It works step by step. It uses rational step-by-step analysis. And if there's any step missing, boom, it's dead. But a human mind works holistically. We take all the data, kind of look at it, synthesize it, do something with it. You may be wrong, but you still made the decision sort of with an intuitive sense, with a holistic assessment of things. And so as a result, you can handle ambiguity. You can handle conflict, diversity, and kind of put it all together in a melting pot and act on it. A rational society can't do that. Career-oriented formal education of children in schools. That's what we've got. Compare that with lifelong learning wherever. Emotion repressed, sometimes called a masculine society. Futurism, emotion surfaced, feminine society, or feminine values. That's why women's lib is more than just women's lib. It can be a reintegration of a whole new way of looking at the world, into our social structures. Forwardism concerned with the structure, futurism concerned with the process. Forwardism uses linear cause and effect logic. It sees a situation that this causes this, this causes this, this causes this, and as a result, this therefore causes this. And that's the extent to which we do most of our analysis of most problems. Futurists insist that it's necessary in complex systems to use more than just that linear type of logic. You have to realize that this causes this, and moreover, this feeds back and causes this again. And that there's feedback loops, there's mutual causality, reciprocal causality, there's emergent behavior. The fact that when you put these two together, this causes this, this causes this, this causes this, and all of a sudden you've got something totally new emerged. An example of that is somebody tried to make a study, why did such and such in a town, right in the middle of the prairie, arise? Here's a big city right in the middle of the prairie. There's railroads going through it now, but it was there before the railroads came. There's no river there. There's no reason why that particular place. And here's this big organism. Is there a cause and effect? It turned out that the initial cause, if you wanted to try and trace it back to the initial cause, was some farmer built his house there. Because by sheer chance, he stumbled out, he didn't know reason, he just had to build somewhere, he puts it there. And then a buddy comes along and builds his house next to it, and a buddy comes along, pretty soon the livery man comes and puts his house there, and pretty soon you've got a little community, and pretty soon it blossoms into a city. Now the interesting part of that is not the original cause. The cause isn't the fact the guy built the house there. The cause, or the interesting thing, is really the whole dynamics which allowed the growth. That's getting too abstract. I'll drop it. Okay, am I done?
Yeah.
I wanted to read one thing in conclusion. What I'm saying here is not, you know, I've done a lot of categorizing of what I've read in other people, and some of it's my ideas, some of it's what I want to point out to you is there's a lot of people saying that this conflict or this polarity is going to be the one of our generation and maybe even next 100 years. I think probably our generation is going to see some kind of resolution of it. I think it helps us to understand the polarity if we're going to try to be mediators. To understand that the people in the forwardist camp are not evil, diabolical people. They believe that what they're doing is for the good of mankind. And to be able to promote communication between the two groups, to be able to bring about conversion experiences, I think it helps to understand the polarity. A lot of people have alluded to this polarity in one way or another. I can name several. Ehrlich I already named. Schumacher I named. Firkas is one of the great guys. He's got a big book called The Future of Technological Civilization, in which he traces classical American liberalism and then gives us his interpretation of this ecological humanism. He's got pages and pages on it, somewhat different from what I've got, but a lot the same. That mankind is at a turning point. I want to read two things. One is from Arc 2. What is happening and what has happened and has been happening in the U.S. and around the world are symptomatic of an impending massive collapse of the industrial order. We are now all caught in a gigantic tragedy of the commons. Each person, each family, and each nation is struggling to stay ahead while the whole system is on the verge of collapse. Many people are not coming to realize the predicament, but it remains to be seen if enough people are willing to break the individual patterns of behavior that are leading to the social destruction. And I want to read one other thing. I'm not going to tell you who this is. I'm going to let you guess. Ownership of property does not constitute for anyone an absolute and unconditional right. No one is justified in keeping for his exclusive use what he does not need when others lack necessities. Rich nations must share their wealth with poor ones, or risk the judgment of God and the wrath of the poor. Any guesses? Ronald Reagan? Karl Marx? Jesus? It's Pope Paul. Yep. That radical. And he was, in some ways. I didn't know he said things like that. I think that's really neat.
Paul the Sixth, the
yeah.
most recent.
Yeah. Okay, now, in conclusion, that wasn't conclusion. This is conclusion. Can't stand this. I always go over.
I love it.
This is out of Fergus. This is how he concludes his book. I hate to do this because the conclusions are... When you've read the whole book and you get this conclusion, it makes you cry. To believe in a green tomorrow is an act of faith which forces one out of the world of philosophy and politics and into the world of epic fables which have so significantly enchanted a generation. It requires one to believe with Tolkien that the dark hordes of Mordor will somehow not prevail against the Shire, and with C.S. Lewis that the lion will return and redeem his kingdom. Yet the universe still abides. Its life processes still go on. Somewhere in deepest space, stars transmute energy in patterns beyond our understanding. The Earth's crust remains restless. Its movements mock human pretensions to dominance over nature. Somewhere hawks still wheel in the sky. Lovers' pulses quicken at the sight of the beloved. Men and women still feel awe at the sacred. Children still marvel at the sea and the sky. The struggling army of the human cause lifts its ragged banners yet again, regroups its broken legions, and prepares for its final battles to preserve its patrimony and to keep the Stargate open. Serene in the knowledge that whatever the future holds, to be human, happened again, Alan. Oh, let's see. To be human means to keep faith with the cosmic processes which made man. The partisans of humanity know in their bones that in a world where doom portends, resistance and life are identical, and that the odds against the survival of human existence can scarcely be greater than those against its creation in the first place. They sing to themselves as they go about their task, merging their silent song with that of every buried seed struggling toward the sun, and of the earth as it spins around its star. Okay. That's my conclusion.
I think one of the things that, well, I continue to item, I guess I'll start with item three there, that the world, this is a world of infinite possibilities, guide a little imagine you can achieve. That has to be our belief, because, that has to be what, I mean, we have to believe that we can achieve what we can imagine. It doesn't have to be, I mean, if we can't imagine a better world, how can we achieve a better world? If we can't imagine a new paradigm, I mean, maybe that's contradictory. Maybe we can't imagine a new paradigm. Maybe a new paradigm has to be imposed on us. But, I, you know, what you said about scientific research, I found to be rather discouraging. And yet, without anybody doing any scientific research, no matter how maybe false it may be, or how, you know, maybe for every 500 guys that are working for a federal grant to get their data in first and faking the data and whatever they're doing, one Copernicus or one Einstein is going to have some new insight. And, mm-hmm. I mean, there got to be some scientists that are doing it right.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Correct?
I agree.
And maybe the task of education starting in the first grade to start teaching people to... maybe do
dream bigger dreams,
a different way, dream in a different way.
Yeah.
And yet we've got to depend on our dreams.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to depend on what we can imagine, I think. And the idea of, I do have faith in technology to solve problems. It may be that it's the faith that technology will do away with itself. I don't know. But I think technology's made some of the problems, and some of them have to be solved by technology.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's anti-scrubbing devices on smokestacks, or whether it's ways to create fuel with methane, or whether it's whatever it is, that's all part of technology.
Mm-hmm.
Technology is not by definition evil.
Yeah, it's not in the futurist category either. Technology can be beneficial when it pays its full social cost.
Yeah, right.
That is, if you take
right.
all the whole system into account, and the technology still...
But I think necessity is the mother of invention.
Mm-hmm. I don't...
Yeah, no.
Like,
okay.
Column 3,
right.
I agree with
yeah.
you. I agree with you completely.
Okay.
When it says this is a world of infinite possibilities, that's fine, and the futurists can embrace that too.
Mm-hmm.
But they embrace it sort of secondarily, or they embrace it with qualification. They don't just kind of say that and then let it set, because it's not a world of infinite possibilities.
Right.
It's a finite. There are certain limitations. It's only so big, for one thing. We're not going to make the Earth bigger. So there are.
But I was going to bring an article over. I forgot it from my astronomy magazine. The science fiction, if anything,
mm-hmm.
the article is. But it's a little article about. It talks about going out into outer space and harnessing an asteroid and mining it.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have the know-how to do that.
Yeah.
Do we have the know-why?
The know-why.
Yeah, I was thinking about that after you mentioned it at lunchtime. I thought that may seem science fiction, but then again, that's limited to the resources that we're using right now. That's already limited scope.
Already what?
A limited scope. I mean, you're mining minerals that we need right now instead of looking for beyond that or
mm-hmm.
the know why.
Mm-hmm.
What concerns me, I guess, in proposals like that, or in proposals like sending up thousands of orbiting space communities
mm-hmm.
as experimental, as some people even talk about that as a way to solve the population problem, and
yeah.
it clearly doesn't do that. But what bothers me about that is that diversion of human creativity and human energy into projects that right now seem doing them because they're possible. Because they're possible, we go that direction rather than looking at what seems to be impossible, and that is establishing a world of human brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
One problem we know how to
somebody
solve, so we go in there and do that because it's a way of spinning our wheels.
But somebody has to go and dream about non-essential things. Some kind of pure researcher. Somebody has got to be thinking about knowledge just for the sake of it.
Uh-huh. I agree.
Maybe not as much.
I think the difference is, the dreams are non-consumptive. You know, it doesn't cost anything to dream, and we can imagine all kinds of possibilities. But the question is then what we do with those dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And the tendency has been, simply because we can imagine it, we go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And partly our present, this is kind of the whole theme of the week in a way, is that the present situation or the decisions we make in the present have been shaped by our dreams about the future. And our dreams about the future have been, up until very recently, types Star Wars, Flash Gordon, 2001. It's kind of curious to take a movie like 2001 and set that up against the Ecotopia book, 1999, same year essentially, year 2000, and say, okay, one is a space, high technology type of vision, and one is a human village type of vision. And all our when I came through with high school and college and grammar school was this totally other type of vision that had the space dream in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, when I tried to dream about the future, I put all the space stuff in my dreams too.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally, I'm a convert in a sense. I converted from one point of view to the other. Finally, at a certain point, I felt that I'm trying to dream the wrong dreams. And it's time for us socially to start looking at what other dreams are possible. And even though they might seem very difficult to achieve, well, so was space travel very difficult to achieve. And we poured billions and billions into it because it was so difficult to achieve, but we knew we could do it. Well, let's have that same attitude about some of the things that need to be done on Earth.
Well, Gary, doesn't it take the same amount, only a different kind of technology, to get into the framework of Ectopia as it does as the Space Corps did?
In other words, it's not that technology is bad, per se.
No.
Yeah, okay.
It's the way it's used for the end result.
I think that's fine. Don't just ask me, ask the group, too.
It takes as much imagination, for one.
Certainly. Yeah.
But to get to the end of Ectopia.
Well, I'm sorry, I haven't read it, so I don't...
Well, those who have, oh, he's got a good excuse.
Well, I assume I know a village, or take Barbara's village.
Well,
Barbara's
the way
village,
of life.
Yeah.
The whole way of life. In other words, to get to the fact that they can get from here to there by X or a certain type of transportation takes a very specific type of technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is one example.
Even conservation takes technology.
That's what I mean.
But that's why I complain when we spend, 90% of our budgets on development of new energy sources and 10% on conservation.
Mm-hmm.
If we switch that around, we'd see a whole new world 10 years from now than we see now. It wouldn't be any poorer. It might be using a lot less energy, but it wouldn't be any poorer necessarily.
That one thing I think is one of the most optimistic. I mean, that to me is within reach. I mean, that could be
that's
done.
That's incremental.
Next
that's
year,
an incremental
this
change.
Year.
Yeah.
That's right here. That's not so far-fetched. And don't you think there's a gradual trend that will start to snowball here? I mean, granted, the amount of recycling that's going on now is minuscule, but there is some.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and more and more people are talking about stuff. I don't know, maybe they're just, but it seems to me that it's bound to snowball. I don't know, that's a real...
That's part of an education process that I'm happy about, too.
Yeah.
Except in Columbus, we've seen recycling go backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There was more being done at one time. All the recycling centers have closed. I think there's one small one that I know of in Columbus, and for a while there were a number of them.
Well, they just can't. I know. My mom
is what it was.
Ran one for a long time, and you just can't keep your head above water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's the difference between bad and a new way of seeing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Until there's a metanoia and a conversion, we're just going to continue to jump on every little fatty wagon.
A friend of ours spent 2 years almost by himself with a pickup truck and cans and a recycling center, but his goal was to prove to the city of Alexandria, Virginia, that it was more profitable to be ecologically sound than foolish, that they were paying more to dump, paying more per ton for solid landfill without reclaiming the aluminum and the glass. And the only thing the citizens have to do is to separate at the curb. Their taxes went down, or I assume the city probably found other uses for the money. The city saved money by recycling. Not recycling centers, but it's the way the trash is picked up in a whole community. It's now the way of life in a community. But it took him 2 years to prove that by being, willing to pick up a lot of trash himself and run things so that he could give statistics and economics.
Yeah.
It amounts to more than you would imagine. My wife and I last spring went down to Arizona and Mexico for a sort of an extended tour, and we met an old man at one of our stops that said he had a panel truck, and we were watching it. He was picking up aluminum cans, and he went through all the garbage cans and picked them out, and he said, this is the way I make my living. He said, I live in my panel truck, and I go through these rest stops and places where he was allowed to do it and pick out the aluminum cans, smashes them flat, puts them in a sack, takes them and gets enough money to buy his gasoline, food, and lives in very comfortably doing this, going around the country. Well, you multiply that by quite a few people, you would solve the problem. Of course, you put these people with the ecological jobs out along the highway picking up the cans, I suppose, put them out of work. But it's feasible, like Mr. I forget his name there just said, it is feasible, because this man proved to us that he was making a living doing it, and he didn't have such a bad looking panel truck.
And he looked pretty cheery besides.
He's enjoying traveling and
the recycling is also going to become increasingly economical as resource costs go up. Right now, it's not as economical. So some people say, oh, don't worry about trying to force recycling prematurely. It'll come anyway. The question is to sort of have a mental state that's ready for it when it does come, or to have the institutions available for paving the way when it does come.
And let the prices go up naturally. Because they're holding down prices on everything.
That's right.
If they let them go up naturally, all this would happen. No, man, we're going to get reelected.
Yeah.
I don't know how to phrase this. Maybe the fundamental question, in some ways, between the two of these, and you gave enough introduction that you already forewarned us of the danger of having the world divided into two groups. I mean, you do kind of set up a straw man whenever you do that, or at least make it too clear cut. There would be nobody who wouldn't do some flipping. If these were the only two choices, I would be on one side or the other, but would do some flipping. The argument against futurism, if we can separate the two, is that it assumes people that can be converted to a new mindset. It assumes a conversion of the mind and sort of ideal people. In other words, if you argue against it, you say innate sinfulness of people will not let you be that cooperative. All right. So, and the argument against forwardism is that it's not getting at the root causes and it's band-aids and what have you. The